Good evening and welcome to Behind the News, the slightly belated edition of Behind the News, October 7, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two interviews up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Njoki Njehu, who is the U.S. director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign, about the recently completed World Bank meetings, their proposals for debt relief, and their rather inadequate proposals for debt relief, and whatever happened to the big demos that used to greet World Bank IMF meetings. None this time around, so we'll talk to Njoki about all those things. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Corey Robin, professor of political science at CUNY, Brooklyn College, and I believe also at the Graduate Center, on his new book, Fear, the History of a Political Idea. And that's just out from Oxford University Press. Before we get to that, to Njoki, an announcement or two. First of all, two guests in this, one frequent guest and one occasional guest on this program, Tariq Ali and Laura Flanders, will be speaking on Monday evening at an event jointly sponsored by Verso and the Brecht Forum. That's Monday, October 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the New School Actors Studio Drama School, which is 151 Bank Street, third floor, New York City. That's 151 Bank Street in the West Beth Complex on 151 Bank Street, third floor. Tariq Ali and Laura Flanders will be having a Columbus Day dialogue on Bush and recolonization. Tariq Ali's book, Bush and Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq, just out from Verso, and Laura Flanders' Bushwoman, Tales of a Cynical Species, recently published by Verso. These two will be talking about the recolonization of Iraq, the role that women play in Bush's cabinet, and what we can do to avert the delegate's strident call for four more years. So a anti-imperialist Columbus Day celebration with Tariq Ali and Laura Flanders coming up this Monday, 7:30 p.m., the New School's Actors Studio Drama School, 151 Bank Street, third floor in the West Bath Complex. And before we get to Njoki, a couple of words about the state of the economy. Okay, not great. The jobless claims, the weekly tally of people who've just lost their jobs and gone over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that fell 37,000 last week. It had been inflated in recent weeks by hurricane effects. And that hurricane effect seems to be undoing itself now that the weather is cleared and Florida is returning to something like normal for Florida. The hurricane also expected to have some kind of impact on tomorrow's employment report, the monthly tally of employment, unemployment, and everything related to the labor markets to be released tomorrow morning, 8:30 a.m. by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. In the past, when there have been hurricanes, it's resulted in very sharp blows to the regular employment trend. So we may see a very low number tomorrow, which will probably be much lower than the actual state of the labor market, which is recovering but still not really, really strong. And it's also tomorrow morning will be released the Labor Department's estimate of how many jobs have been undercounted or overcounted in the past year. They do an annual check with the unemployment insurance records, which cover almost the entire employment universe. The month-to-month numbers are just based on a sample survey, and once a year they correct those with a very, very broad and accurate count. The Bush administration hoping we're going to get a big upward revision. That's really not likely. I think we're going to get a medium-sized, just small to medium-sized upward revision. And in any case, not enough to erase Bush's record as the only president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a decline in employment. Since tomorrow night's political debate, presidential debate between Kerry and Bush will probably focus heavily on the economy, this deep geekery of how to count employment may actually have some political salience, but may not, depending upon how big the number is. We'll find out tomorrow morning at 8:30. Other signs of a slowing economy in the United States, weaker chain store sales, decline in consumer credit, and also we're seeing similar things abroad. A modest decline in the Japanese unemployment rate in August, but that came after a sharp increase in July, which was not reversed. So recovery in Japan, but some signs that recovery is losing a little bit of its steam. And Western Europe's economy is actually retail sales declined surveys of purchasing managers in both the manufacturing and service industries. Still positive, but less so than in recent months. So Europe's tentative economic recovery also seems to be losing steam and a bit more than Japan's. So we now have Njoki and Jehu on the line. Sorry for that rushed rehearsal of the economic headlines, but thanks to the switch problems at Chambers Street, we got a late start. But now we're joined by Njoki and Jehu, who is the U.S. director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign, and actually now we're on 60 years of the World Bank and the IMF, so maybe it's time to change the name. Welcome to WBAI, Njoki.
Thank you, Doug.
So 60 years now, is it still enough?
I think it's too much. we've heard a lot. We've heard that joke quite a bit. But I think that what this 60th anniversary year has given us is an opportunity to again take a long term view of the record of the institutions, and you know, the fact of the matter is that we still find them wanting.
Well, yeah, and if we look at the broad sweep of history, the gaps between the rich and poor countries of the world, with some exceptions, have never been wider. So if their mission is to do something about reducing those gaps, the long-term record shows they've failed rather miserably.
Right, and I mean, and when the World Bank presented their World Development Report, they did talk about 500 million people who have been lifted out of poverty, but would... The details, as they say, the devil is in the details, and the fact of the matter was that 500 million people were in mostly in China and in India, sort of World Bank IMF speak, two bad students of the neoliberal economic model, two bad students of the economic model that the World Bank and the IMF have been promoting. They're not countries, they're not economies that have been very open, they've been quite protective. They're not economies that have privatized on a large scale, which is what we see these institutions recommending and pushing countries to do across the globe. So it is in fact, in some ways, an indictment of their own economic model, that the places where there has been progress and improvement in terms of the conditions of people living in poverty have been in the two countries that are big enough in terms of population and size of economy that they could not be coerced in the same way a Haiti or, you know, or a Kenya or a Nicaragua might be coerced, and so did not follow the model as closely.
And if we look at the star students of the World Bank and the IMF, early 90s was Mexico, which was supposed to be doing everything right, and then it had an economic crisis
in
94, 95,
right,
and it
right.
was forgotten as the star student. And then in the late 90s was Argentina,
which
then hit a wall and had one of the sharpest economic crises of any country in recent history. And now, of course, the IMF, I saw their new director, Rodrigo de Otto, at the Council on Foreign Relations a few weeks ago, and Rato, who has since added the aristocratic D back into his name, curiously,
right.
was blaming Argentina for its own problems. So they'd forgotten that it was the star pupil of the IMF and the World Bank
right.
in the late
and
90s,
although,
and now it's just brought its troubles on itself.
Right, and although, again, about a month and a half, 2 months ago, there was a story in the Washington Post saying, in sort of that half-hearted way that the IMF will say, you know, they followed our advice and maybe we are to blame for the problems that they have. They did actually have an admission in the Washington Post talking about that I can't remember exactly the language that they used, but they were in some ways taking responsibility for the failures of what had happened in Argentina. And how could they not, you know, when, you know, they were so gung-ho and sort of praising them. I was talking with my colleague Soren Ambrose, who was looking at a book by Paul Krugman written in, I think, 98, 99, that was hailing the success of Argentina and what was going on in Argentina. Of course, that was before the crisis of 2001 and the complete economic meltdown of the country. And this is what we continue to see. You talked about Mexico in the early 90s. In the late 90s, we also saw the financial crisis in the East Asian economies. And, you know, though South Korea wasn't quite in the same class as Indonesia and Taiwan. Those were the two other economies that had been good pupils, and they really did have a big meltdown. And in fact, one of the problems of solving the financial crisis, the East Asian financial crisis, was that South Korea was forced to take on a lot of the economic tenants, a lot of the tenants of economic of the economic model of the World Bank and the IMF that they had actually avoided for a very long time. So it is a model that has failed and continues to be self-perpetuating. But also, as I've said on this radio station, I don't know whether it was on your program, it's the case that when you look at, for instance, what the U.S. government, what the Bush administration did in response to the economic turndown following the tragic events of September 11, they were actually the exact opposite of what economies that are in crisis in the South have been told to do. We saw, for instance, Greenspan lower interest rates time and time again, which was one of the things that Argentina was told absolutely under no circumstances were they to lower interest rates. We saw a bailout of the airline industry. We saw steel tariffs that were imposed by the Bush administration. We saw the so-called farm bill that put about $100 billion in farm subsidies over 10 years. So again, not what economists in the South are told to do. We saw the U.S. and Canada announce that they were not going to pay any attention to the patent that Bayer holds for Cipro following the anthrax scares, because as they said, it was the anthrax attacks presented a huge public health crisis to the U.S. and to Canada. At that point, by the way, only one person had died in the U.S. And we think, by the way, I happen to believe that what the U.S. did then to protect vulnerable sectors, to protect public health, was the right thing to do. The only problem is that it is not. This is not allowed to economists in the South. It was not allowed to Argentina. It's not allowed for African, sub-Saharan African countries that are dealing with the HIV/AIDS pandemic, 8,000 people dying every day. This is a problem of the double standard, but it is actually that this model hasn't worked, and they don't follow it. They've never followed it themselves.
Yeah, and of course, the United States is a country that has very large and growing foreign debts, a big foreign payments imbalance, big current account deficit, big budget deficit. And if we were an ordinary country, the IMF would be running in, tell us to tighten our belt and cause a recession and throw people out of work to get things back into balance. But when you're the boss, you don't have to do those things.
You don't have to do that. With the U.S., being the largest shareholder at the World Bank and the IMF, they get to tell other people what to do, but they don't have to do it. It's a sort of a do not what I do as I tell you, not as I do kind of arrangement. And this is really the crisis that this economic and development model is encountering. It's what they encountered in Cancun when you had a sort of a coalition of countries from Asia, Latin America, and Africa coming together and saying, we are not going to take that deal. You know, granted that they've come around and kind of scored the kind of deal that they wanted to a great extent. But there are moments where the inconsistencies in the system, the sort of the hypocrisy of the system of where the rulemakers are they themselves not following the rules, become just too great, and the tension and the contradiction is too huge to be ignored anymore.
And since we got a late start, let's move along, because at the top of the agenda for the recent IMF World Bank annual meetings, which happen every year at the end of September, beginning of October, they were supposed to be discussing debt relief for the poorest countries of the world. The British made a proposal to buy off some of that debt. What happened at the end of the meetings?
Well, let me just start by saying that, you know, for decades, campaigners, economic justice and global justice campaigners have been calling for the sort of the need for debt cancellation. And, you know, also to be clear that there has been debt relief granted to groupings of countries and to individual countries from time to time, whether you're talking about Jordan or you're talking about Pakistan or Poland or other countries. There has been debt relief provided. But for the most part, it hasn't really been, it has been piecemeal, and it hasn't really addressed comprehensively and definitively the debt crisis that is both a scandal and outrageous in terms of what the debt is costing in lives and the heritage and the future of many countries and generations to come. And in going back to the G7 summit this year, which was held in Savannah, Georgia, there was a proposal, there were reports and rumors and even a couple newspaper articles talking about a proposal to do 100% cancellation of the debt claimed by the World Bank and the IMF, meaning multilateral debt, the debt that is claimed by the World Bank and the IMF. And that deal did not go through because some of the G8 countries were insisting that the proposal be both about what there was general consensus, the odious debt of Iraq, this argument, and absolutely right argument that has been made that the people of Iraq should not be forced to pay the debt of Saddam, a debt that was borrowed in their name, that was squandered, and that or was in fact applied to oppress them. And in the interest of equality, many people are saying this is true of the debt of Saddam Hussein, the debt of Iraq, but it's also true of apartheid debt and Nigeria's debt and Indonesia's debt and the debts of the military dictatorships in Argentina, Chile, and Brazil. But the U.S. had been sort of saying that, in fact, Condoleezza Rice said that it was not a quid pro quo. A deal on Iraq's debt did not mean a deal for the heavily indebted or the highly indebted poor countries. And that deal fell apart. That agreement fell apart. At the meetings this past week, the proposal was again on the table for 100% cancellation of the debts of impoverished countries. And they had a list of anywhere between 30 and 40 countries that were being considered. And again, the deal did not come through. But I think what is important for your listeners to know is that this is huge in terms of the fact that we had the proposal, and in terms of sort of movement forward and the political point being made here in 96, before they came forward with the piecemeal HIPIC initiative, the heavily indebted poor country initiative that has not worked all this time. The World Bank and the IMF had been maintaining that they could not do debt relief. They were not allowed to do with their charter. So to come from there to the HIPIC initiative to a consideration of 100% debt cancellation, it's huge. And I think that part of the disagreement is the financing. We think that the IMF should revalue the $30 to $40 billion in gold that they have, which a while back was applied to a similar sort of piecemeal scheme to do debt relief. But I think that it is a huge, almost victory, shall I say. We don't yet have the victory, but I think we have really come a long way in terms of the campaigns for debt cancellation.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but in previous years there were big demonstrations greeting the World Bank and the IMF. There were none this time. What's going on with the movement?
Well, not very much in terms that is very different, but what is different this time is that this is a presidential year in the U.S. That's one thing. And it's also that the movement really, you know, is at a different stage. I was talking about this yesterday, saying how in many, there are lots of new places that we are being invited to have these conversations, whether, you know, earlier this week as I was at George Washington University Law School. Next week I'm going to Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas, and a lot of other places that I can give you as examples where, you know, we have not been having the conversation there. We did not call for a big mobilization. We did not think that we needed to call for a big mobilization, but there were all kinds of action alerts, tens of thousands of people who called and faxed the White House saying, you know, the time is now to do 100% debt cancellation. So we're moving forward, and we do not think that it requires tens of thousands of people on the streets for this movement to continue moving. We did have a overnight vigil outside the World Bank and the IMF where we watched and waited and hoped that they would, you know, turn the proposal into a decision. It did not happen, but we are not giving up. And it's also the fact that in India, in Sri Lanka, in South Africa, in the Philippines, and several other places, there were people marking the 60th anniversary of this institution. So the movement is growing strong and moving forward and maturing and expressing itself and manifesting in different ways.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and thanks for the work you're doing. And Jokin Jehu, who is the U.S. director of the 50 Years is Enough campaign. We'll be back in just a moment after this break.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
This is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, and let's take a little musical break to set the tone for the next segment, and we'll be back with Corey Robin.
Homes living like a man on the run, trails leading nowhere, where to my son? We're already dead, but not yet in the ground. Come on, shake my helping hand, I'll show you around. You know it makes sense, don't even think about it. Life and death are things you just do.
Now that was John Cale's song, Say Fear is a Man's Best Friend, from his album Fear. And we're joined by Corey Robin, who is the author of a book called Fear, The History of a Political Idea, just out from Oxford University Press. Corey also teaches at Brooklyn College. Welcome to WBAI, Corey.
Thanks for having me.
I don't think of fear as my best friend, but it's somebody's friend. Whose friend is fear?
Well, I'd say first and foremost, it's usually a friend of people in power. People in power in two senses. One, fear is the classic political tool for keeping and pursuing power, not just in the kind of obvious cases of Nazi Germany or Stalinist Soviet Union, but also in the United States. There's a long history of using fear in that regard. But I also think it's actually, surprisingly enough, intellectuals' best friends, and that's one of the things I talk about and sort of discovered in the course of writing this book. There's a long history going back really to the Bible, but it actually gets going, I would say, in the 17th century of political writers looking to fear in certain contexts when there's a lot of uncertainty about what we call sort of positive political morality, justice, equality, freedom. When philosophers and writers are uncertain or confused about the meaning of those words, there is a tendency to turn to fear as what's called a negative foundation for society. In other words, we don't know the meaning of things like good and what's good, what's just, but we do know what is evil or bad. We know what it is to be afraid of that, and we can turn to that as our friend to create a society. And so this is an old story that I trace in my book, but so I would say those are the sort of the two main categories of groups or types of people who tend to turn to fear and see it as their best friend.
And, of course, I want to get – this is very relevant in our political environment in the United States today, having just watched the fearful, frightening Dick Cheney the other night on TV, it's very much in the front of my mind. But let's review some of the history of this. You write at length of about four political philosophers, Hobbes, Montesquieu, Tocqueville, and Hannah Arendt. So let's do the quick Cliff's Notes version of each of these contributions to the history of an idea. And this is, you are tracing a history of an idea. It's something that's evolved over time. It's not something that's given to us timeless from the 18th century. Hobbes, of course, has entered popular imagination as the philosopher of the war of each against all, the state of nature, a very frightening idea of human life. So what's his contribution to this, the theory of fear?
Well, I think there's a few. Hobbes was really the first thinker that we have in the Western tradition who imagined that fear could actually be the basis for creating a moral society. This is a really counterintuitive idea. But Hobbes was the one who confronted this problem of permanent, irreconcilable differences. We tend to think of this as a very recent phenomenon, but actually Hobbes confronted it, where people disagree fundamentally about the meaning of words like good, where not only do they disagree, but they cannot come to an agreement. And Hobbes advanced was the first time
he didn't really believe in some transcendental good or evil. It was all a matter of personal subjectivity.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we would call it sort of a relativist position. It's not exactly the right word, but he was the first one to really get that. But what he said was that in that context, there is only one thing that is indisputable, and that is that you need – whatever your vision of justice is, whatever your vision of the good is, you have to be alive in order to pursue it, that it's a fundamental philosophical absurdity, he argued, to pursue something to the point of death, because then you can no longer pursue it, much less enjoy it. So you have to be alive, and the correlate of that was the fear of death, that was the emotion that would teach you the virtue of being alive, the virtue of self-preservation.
And at this time, there were some Puritan revolutionaries who loved death and look forward to, kind of like Muhammad Atta, were looking forward to their reward in heaven.
Well, it wasn't so much that they were looking forward to it, but I think what they basically thought was that it was more important to die with honor, more important to die having pursued revolutionary virtue than it was to live having betrayed it. That was the fundamental thing. And this is what people always miss about Hobbes. They think that Hobbes described a world where people naturally fear death. Nothing could have been farther from the truth. Hobbes confronted a world where people did not fear death, and he wanted to create a world where people would fear death. In other words, this was a project, a political and cultural project. And so for all these intellectuals today, neocons and people who want to invoke him as saying, oh, yes, he describes the world as it is, it's exactly the opposite. He described the world as he hoped it would become.
In the interest of promoting what?
Well, first of all, in the interests of promoting an absolute authoritarian form of government. He thought that that was the only kind of government that would create a sort of decent order. And that was the goal. You know, he wanted to crush these Puritan revolutionaries who he thought were insane, literally insane. And fear was designed, he thought, to create a regime. He called it Leviathan. He liked sort of scary-sounding names like that. He wrote one book called Leviathan, another one called Behemoth, these sort of Old Testament-type names. And the goal was to create a regime that would use fear first and foremost as a tool of social and political organization, and not just a regime, not just a government. And here's where I think the relevance of Hobbes to today is even greater. Many people don't realize this about Hobbes. He had a very subtle understanding of how the government would work with what we today call civil society. In his time, this was universities and churches. These were the premier institutions of social and organization that were not directly controlled by the state. In his utopian vision, we would say, he thought that the government could teach, work with universities, who would then teach preachers, who would then go out into the rest of society and preach this new gospel of fear. So he had a very subtle understanding of the relationship between state and society. Now, we don't have the same kind of culture industries today in terms of, well, we do have the churches and so forth, but I wouldn't say that those are the primary ones for, you know, for teaching fear. I think we have other ones as well. One of the ones I talk about in the book is the media, but we can get to that later.
Yeah, and the maintenance of this kind of order required all of us to internalize this fear. It wasn't just a kind of police state terror. It was the fear was within us.
Right? Absolutely. I mean, this is why I think Hobbes is so much more sophisticated than people realize. If you look at someone like Machiavelli, his predecessor, Machiavelli had, I would argue, a much more simplistic understanding of fear. Fear was really, you know, at the end of a stick, and it was the prince's weapon, and the prince had to go out and use it against his people. And it's a very antagonistic conception of the relationship between the prince and the people. Hobbes had a much more chilling understanding of how people themselves would not only internalize this fear, but actually come to believe that it was good for them. That was the key, was that they had to understand that fear was in their own self-interest. And therefore, if they could understand that, not only would they submit to the state, but then they would tell their friends, who would tell their friends, who would tell their friends. And each person would be kind of a relay station, as it were, of state power. And again, I think that's why we tend to think of fear in these very simple terms as sort of an automatic response to pain or death. Hobbes understood that, no, you have to ally fear with a very firm, robust conception of what's in your own self-interest, what is for your own good. And once you come to understand that, then you will be all the more likely to fear, not only to fear something, but to think that that fear is your friend, to quote your song.
A lot of that sounds quite contemporary, actually. I'm speaking with Corey Robin, who is the author of Fear, The History of a Political Idea, just out from Oxford University Press. And let's move on to Montesquieu, who is thought of as a great inspiration to our founding fathers. Madison, big fan of Montesquieu. His great fear was despotism, and yes. He was the sort of liberal philosopher. How does he fit into the schema?
Well, in two interesting ways. One, for all of Montesquieu's differences, I mean, Montesquieu is the classic political liberal. Hobbes is not a liberal by any stretch of the imagination. But Montesquieu picked up on one of Hobbes's key insights, which is that at these moments of great moral doubt and confusion, fear can actually be a source of legitimating claims for a type of government. He slightly changed it, though. What he did was to create this idea of despotism. And in the book, I think it's I call it a cartoonish vision, which I think it was. It's sort of, you know, the kind of Caligula as the despot, who's a sort of a sadistic, cruel figure who uses violence and fear, not for any real political reason, but because he enjoys it. He's a sadist, essentially. It's a very psychological, primitive psychology primitive psychology understanding of the way despotic terror, as he called it, works. But he invoked this image because he thought that if you understood that as the great thing to be worried about, to be afraid of, you would then turn to his alternative, which was a liberal society of moderate government with divided powers, fragmented state institutions. Montesquieu is the first sort of theorist of what we think of as the separation of powers, the rule of law, and a kind of pluralistic society. That all of these things, which had no positive justifications, but could be have a negative justification. In other words, it's sort of Winston Churchill's, this is the worst of all systems except for all the others. That is Montesquieu's contribution. And what I argue that is in the process, though, he really comes up with what I call this very cartoonish idea of how these despotic regimes actually work on the one hand. And then on the other hand, he overlooks, and his successors really overlook, the way in which his positive prescriptions, the rule of law, the separation of powers, and social pluralism, at least in the American context, don't serve as checks against fear, but actually serve as the conduits or transmission belts of fear in the American context, which, again, we can talk about.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. And then Tocqueville, of course, one of the most quoted political philosophers of all time for his and the conservatives love to quote Tocqueville. But you write about him as having, the two volumes of Democracy in America having very different personalities. Talk a bit about that.
Well, let me talk really about the second one, because I think that's the one that's the more influential and the more important. Tocqueville, I would argue, is the inventor of the concept of anxiety in the sociological sense, in that as his idea was that as we—
In this sort of cultural sense of the age of anxiety that became popular in the 50s.
Absolutely. But it's, you know, it gets picked up in the 19th century as well by theorists like Durkheim and Tunis, Heidegger in the 20th century, Hannah Arendt, and a whole bunch of others. His basic idea was that the French Revolution, the age of revolution, has overthrown the old regime. And Tocqueville was extremely ambivalent about the loss of the old regime. He thought that, what that did was to create a society that was atomistic. It had atomistic and anomic. In other words, there was no social cohesion anymore. He misconstrued the overthrow of traditional hierarchy with the obliteration of all forms of social organization. This is the classic conservative misconception, which is that if you overthrow traditional forms of hierarchy, you have destroyed every form of social organization. In the face of that loss, he claimed, people experience neither Hobbesian fear nor Montesquieu's terror. What they experience instead is what I call anxiety. In other words, this sort of the nervousness of the loss of social cohesion makes people extremely anxious. But it's an anxiety with no focus. It has no object to it except the sense that something has been taken away from us. And in the face of that, he argued, people tend to turn to tyrannical government as the answer to that sense of loss because it restores a sense of authority. This is going to be an extremely influential interpretation that's going to come up again and again and again, most famously, as you say, during the 1950s, where it was applied to accounts of totalitarian societies. In the 1960s and 70s, it was sort of laughed at, this theory. It was discarded as not very credible. But interestingly enough, after the Cold War, and certainly since 9/11, it has been revived with a vengeance. This is now the classic interpretation of radical Islam, which is that it is a reaction to modernity, essentially, is to the loss of...
Fundamentalist Christianity.
Or fundamentalist Christianity in our own country, yeah. I mean, and this is, you were talking before about conservatives, but it's actually people on the left continuously invoke this theory of what it is that drives things like fundamentalism. And I argue that it's a very... psychological cultural interpretation that ignores what I think is the more political dimensions of fear.
And then finally, Arendt, in this rapid review of the literature, famous for her book on totalitarianism and really introducing that concept into a lot of popular thought, but then later for writing on Eichmann.
Right.
So different perspectives.
I mean, Arendt's theory and the origins of totalitarianism is somewhat similar to Tocqueville's theory. It's essentially people turn to Nazism and Stalinism, fascism and communism as an answer to the great angst that is produced by modernity. I mean, that's a very simplistic, but that's essentially what her account is. So, just the contrast with Hobbes couldn't be greater. With Hobbes, government goes out and creates fear. Now we get to the point where in this account, people are naturally afraid or anxious, and then they turn and create a repressive government. It's completely inverting the direction of how fear is created.
Which, empirically speaking, isn't really a great explanation of the rise of Nazism.
Not at all. I mean, and every single historian and social scientist, even people like Daniel Goldhagen, have rejected that theory as having absolutely no credibility. If you look at Nazi Germany, Nazi fascism was promoted by elites, first and foremost, and these were not people who were anxious by the modern world. These were people who were politically threatened by organized mass movements, that dispossessing them of their power, which they viewed as part of a Jewish conspiracy. But it worked through, and then once Nazism came into being, it worked through, traditional social institutions, the churches, the universities. There's a great new book out by Claudia Kuntz called The Nazi Conscience, and she traces this, I think, quite brilliantly. Just the thickness of the sort of social impenetration of Nazism, and likewise in the case of Stalinism as well. I mean, all the great, Soviet historians going through the archives have just shown that this was not just some anxious movement in response to modernity, as Arendt tried to claim, but that Stalinism was very much of a top-down movement that worked, but also had grassroots collaborators, embedded institutions, part of a new sort of social force that wanted to use terror for their own purposes. So that the argument has been totally discredited. But what's interesting to me is that despite the fact that so many historians have discredited it, among philosophers, literary critics, sort of public intellectuals, this idea seems to have, more than nine lives. It keeps coming back over and over and over again. And what's doubly interesting is that Arendt herself, as I argue, in Eichmann in Jerusalem, herself came to think that this theory was somewhat cockamamie. And Eichmann in Jerusalem is in many ways a total repudiation of everything she had written in Origins of Totalitarianism.
Well, their participation in terror is a good career move.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly what it is. It's careerism, collaboration. These, I would argue, are the categories for understanding a whole range of regimes of fear, from the less benign in the form of something like McCarthyism to the ones of, you know, absolute horror like Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia, that it's careerism and collaboration. In other words, the self-interested behavior of men and women trying to advance through institutions, not the obliteration of institutions, and then the anxiety that allegedly arises from that. But nobody wants to deal with questions of careerism and collaboration, because in many ways, if you did, you would start entering upon a lot of the sort of sacred dogmas of our own time, because it, you know, careerism and collaboration fit very nicely with a kind of free market ideology of individualism and sort of advancing yourself regardless of the consequences.
And it implicates too many ordinary people in the enterprise, and it's much more pleasing to have an explanation that some almost external bad guy is responsible
Absolutely.
For it. I'm speaking with Corey Robin, author of Fear, the History of a Political Idea, just out from Oxford University Press. And let's now talk about the present. I've had you on the show before to talk about a piece you did that was originally in the Boston Review, and it's incorporated as a chapter here.
Partially, yeah.
Yeah, about what happened after 9/11 in this country. And a lot of conservatives were saying, or even Christopher Hitchens had almost erotic delight in the new world created by 9/11, that we had during the Clinton years, we had an economic boom. Everybody is too fat and comfortable and concerned with home renovations and the stock market portfolios. And then suddenly these hijacked airplanes and collapsing buildings brought us back to our senses and gave us a sense of social purpose and discipline.
Yeah. I mean, this was a sentiment that was voiced by, you know, actually across the political spectrum, David Brooks on the left, George Packer sort of in the more liberal center, and then Hitchens. I would like to read this quote because I feel like it's never really gotten the attention that I think it ought to. I mean, remember, Christopher Hitchens is somebody who after 9/11 was canonized as the Orwell of our time and the conscience of the left. This is what he said after 9/11 in December of 2001. I should perhaps confess that on September 11th last, once I had experienced all the usual mammalian gamut of emotions from rage to nausea, I also discovered that another sensation was contending for mastery. On examination and to my own surprise and pleasure, it turned out to be exhilaration. Here was the most frightful enemy, theocratic barbarism, in plain view. I realized that if the battle went on until the last day of my life, I would never get bored in prosecuting it to the utmost. You know, this is the man who is the Orwell of our times. And I think it says something that he has been so canonized by people in the New York Times and so forth afterwards, because I think he's speaking volumes there, not about just himself, but about a whole class of intellectuals who, as you said, felt like the 90s was really, you know, kind of boring time, and that this is fun.
Peace and prosperity, even though it was not universally enjoyed, is tedious. Or tedious, and what we really need is war and excitement and a sense of national purpose.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly, you know, and again, these ideas are fairly old, but it would be a mistake to think that they were consigned solely to the right or even someone like Hitchens. I mean, I think you find it across the spectrum.
Some months ago, I saw David Brooks on TV, I think it was David Brooks or one of those dweebs, saying something to the effect that George Bush, it's still September 12th, the rest of us have moved on. And it seems that the Bush administration is very busily trying to recreate that feeling that Hitchens was talking about there. That's really the centerpiece of their political campaign.
Absolutely. And here's, I think, where the politics of this all becomes important. I mean, we've been talking about this as a kind of response of intellectuals to these vague moral concerns about the loss and decadence of society. What we have to remember is that fear, as Hobbes argued, is first and foremost, it is a tool of political power. It is a tool of intimidation. People have been talking about the Bush administration whipping up fear in the Cheney debate, the Cheney comment about Kerry. If you actually look at the programs themselves, which very few people actually look at, it's astonishing how much they've actually managed to change in terms of reorienting power relationships in this country in the name of fear. Just to give you a quick example, the Department of Homeland Security the big battle over, you know, I think it has something like 180,000, 170,000 employees. And there was a big battle in terms of whether or not those employees would be entitled to civil service and union protections. Some of these civil service protections going back to the time of the Republican Party after Abraham Lincoln. The position of the Bush administration was that these employees ought to be stripped of those protections in order, in the words of Tom Ridge, to be as agile as the terrorists themselves. Now, mind you, the Defense Department, I mean, when we say 170,000 employees, a lot of these people are clerical employees, they're janitors, they're not people who are involved in questions of security per se. The Defense Department, if you're a clerical employee, you have all the same, you have union civil service protections, but in the Homeland Security Department, you do not. And after this bill passed, mind you, it passed when the Democrats were still in control of the Senate. It was right after the November 2002 election. It passed the Senate. Mitch Daniels, the OMB director, said that now that we have this in place, this is now going to be a model for restructuring employee relations throughout the federal government. Well, of course, the federal government is where, you know, labor unions are the one place where labor unions have managed to get a foothold in this country. And so they're very clear that this is a tool not just for winning a campaign. I think people just think they want to just have power for its own sake. Nothing could be further true, at least on the domestic front. They have a very – I mean, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but they have a vision for restructuring social relations in this country and fear not just of terrorism but the fear of looking weak on terrorism. I mean, that's what they really have used against the Democrats is their primary weapon. And that's just one example, but there are many others as well.
We're just about out of time, but I should say that you're going to be at the Brecht Forum coming up October 14th, Thursday, October 14th. That's a week from tonight at 7:30, the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street, but for not much longer, but 122 West 27th Street, 10th floor. That's a week from tonight, Thursday, October 14th at 7:30. And I guess I should put an end to it there because we're just about out of time. Thanks for joining us, Corey Robin. The book, Fear, The History of a Political Idea, just out from the Oxford University Press. And also remember Tariq Ali and Laura Flanders, another Brecht Forum event co-sponsored with Verso coming up this Monday, October 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the New School Actors Studio Drama School, 151 Bank Street, 3rd floor, New York City. That's in the West Beth Complex, the soon-to-be home of the Brecht Forum. And Tariq Ali and Laura Flanders will be talking about Bush recolonization and imperialism on Columbus Day. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this old song from Johnny Winter, which can't really decide whether it's a temperance lecture or an exhortation to drink deep.
Death machine, scar.